Where's Terry tonight? Are you, Terry, you here? Not here? He'll be here at the second hour, I guess. He's doing a good work. We're very fortunate to have him. Of course, you're aware of that. I hope you are. He's a good man. And he's a man who constantly keeps himself under the, well, the all-searching eye of God. He's a man who is becoming. Terry has not become. He would resent if I were to say he had become a good man. He's on his way there. And that probably says more than to say that he has become a good man. But he is a good man. I love him and am thankful for him. We're glad for those of you who are visitors. Hope you come back when you can and be with us at every opportunity. I'm thankful especially for the good singing. It's such a great thrill to me to be able to be just a stick preaching after that kind of singing. You do a good work in your encouragement of other people and of me by your very enthusiastic singing. Last Sunday night, we began a series of two sermons, really, on the introduction to the life of Christ. I did this in an attempt to get you an overview of the life of Christ. I think it would be unwise to jump into a study of the life of Christ without getting some kind of an overview of the man, so that we might be able to have a greater insight into the one we're studying about. He is so inconceivable in the sense that he's not containable within our capacities. And consequently, I feel like I have to get a running start as far as I can in order to even come close to understanding him. So for that reason, last Sunday night, we saw him as a man whose humanity anchors him in history. Now, we meant by that he was born of a woman. He was born about B.C. 5. He was born during about approximately the 22nd year of the reign of Caesar Augustus, the emperor of Rome. And because of a mistaken calendar, whenever they dated our whole era from his birth, there was a mistake in the calendar discovered hundreds of years later, and instead of backing off this end, they backed up the other end and had him then be born about B.C. 5, B.C. 4. He was taken to Egypt, and they stayed there for about 2 years because of Herod, who was trying to kill him. And then in about B.C. 3, his father took Jesus and his mother, and they went to the city of Nazareth and lived there. And Jesus was raised in the city of Nazareth, as you're aware, for about 30 years. Jesus was the oldest of about 7 children. And you say, why do you say 7? Well, he had 4 brothers, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas. He had a plurality of sisters. We don't know how many because their names are not given. But he had a plurality, which means he had at least 2. So he had 4 brothers and at least 2 sisters who were younger than he, which would have meant that he was the eldest of at least 7 children and maybe more. His life is characterized by those things that are ordinarily characteristic of human beings. He hungered, he thirsted, he became weary, he became sleepy, he became sad, he was filled at least once on one occasion, we know, with joy, and exclaimed in a moment of joy that he was glad that God had hidden these truths from the wise and prudent and had revealed them to babes. He was involved in an occupation, a work. He was a carpenter, perhaps a stonemason, but nevertheless a carpenter in the broader sense of the term. He was subject to death. And there were many other things that characterized Jesus that are just like you and me. Consequently, we can read of his life without raising an eyebrow some of the things of his life. And yet he was a man that could not be contained within the normal confines of human classifications. He could not be put into a phyla or into a classification that would be broad enough to contain just you and me as human beings. He was too broad for that. He was too deep for that. He was too long for that, if you please. He defies those normal classifications. There was one thing we noticed last week about him that I hope you understand and get the implications of it. I'm not sure that you do. I've got a good mind to ask you to hold your hand up if you do not understand what we meant when we said this man had no consciousness of sin. Now, that is a psychological impossibility. Not that he was just unconscious of sin, but that he, as being unconscious of sin, was then and is now and always has been recognized as the epitome of moral uprightness. Now, there are a lot of people who are unconscious of sin, but they are either sociopaths, like Hitler, killing 6 million Jews and doing it with a high hand, or else they are morons or people who have no mental capacity. But never in the history of the world has anyone ever been recognized as being the epitome of that which is good and right and morally upright, and at the same time be unconscious of sin. This man had no consciousness of having ever done anything wrong. He had no consciousness of having said anything, thought anything, done anything that was less than perfect. Now that has to be reckoned with, and I'm asking you just simply to take it home with you and think about it. And if you don't understand it, please tell me, because I want you to get this impact that this fact brings upon your life as you consider the person of Jesus Christ. Now, tonight, I'm going to ask again, who was Jesus? What kind of a man was he? And I want to make just perhaps one observation. We may not get through but one, but if we can, we'll get through both of these tonight and draw this introductory series to a close. He was a man whose presence was contrary to all the local human expectations of him. Now, you're aware of this from Isaiah, the 53rd chapter. Isaiah had said that he would be a man that would be misunderstood. Who has believed what we've heard, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had no form nor comeliness that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised or overlooked, and we did not recognize him. We esteemed him not. Jesus, in this respect, was a man whose presence was contrary to what was humanly and normally expected of him. Now, in this way in particular, Jesus did not fit the common preconception of the role of the Messiah held by most of the people of his day. In fact, I think it would be held by all of the people of his day. Jesus did not fit the common mold that the people held regarding the Messiah. They thought he was going to be something else. They had a different concept altogether about the Messiah. He was not anything like what Jesus was. Jesus did not fit anything near like what the people of his day thought the Messiah was supposed to be. Now, there was a very common and a very broad expectancy and anticipation of the coming of the Messiah. This thing had been rooted in Jewish history for hundreds of years. And consequently, by this time, the momentum had been such and had gained such momentum that the people were anxiously anticipating the coming of the Messiah. Their anticipation of the Messiah varied in direct proportion to the oppressions under which they found themselves. And at that particular time, they had been without interruption under oppression from either the Seleucids, the Grecian or the Seleucid arm of the Grecian Empire, from Judas Maccabeus on, or he was one of the ones that we'll mention in a moment. But these people had been under an uninterrupted occupation force, either from the Seleucids or from the Romans. And, of course, their anticipation of the coming Messiah had been heightened because of this oppressiveness that had been brought upon them by these foreign occupation forces. Well, they had this concept of the Messiah. They looked upon him as coming on a white horse to rid them of the Roman scourge, to get rid of this Roman curse, and they were looking upon the Messiah to do this service for them. For example, the woman of Samaria, she was looking even for the Messiah. When she said, "Well, I know that the Messiah is coming, and when he does, he'll tell us all these things." Jesus said, "I that speak unto thee am he." She was looking for the Messiah. She wasn't even a Jew, but she accepted his coming as a matter of fact. Again, there was a fisherman named Andrew who went to Simon Peter, his brother, in excitement and said, "We have found the Messiah." Or then in John, the 7th chapter, when the common people of the street, seemingly standing in the street, that's the picture I get, of these people standing in the street or the marketplace or perhaps in the enclosure of the temple, the outer court rather, the court or the temple where the people milled around. It seems that they were standing in some public place at least and were saying, "This man is the Christ," some of them said. Others said, "Well, now, wait a minute. Does the Christ come from Galilee? Does not the Scripture say that the Christ is to be born in Bethlehem, that he is a descendant of David and comes from the village of Bethlehem where David was born?" And so there was this division. But the point I'm making is that the people were constantly in the process of examining Jesus of Nazareth in the light of the common expectancy that they had of the Messiah. And Jesus just simply did not fit it. Those who knew him knew that he did not, in fact, he would not fit that common mold. Terry mentioned some days ago about the time in John 6 when the people tried to take him and by force make him king. Jesus, it says, when he perceived that they were coming to take him by force and make him king, withdrew by himself to the hills. And that's where he just got away from them. He would not become the victim of the messianic expectations of his own people. He would not become the victims of a political opportunity to become some kind of a political king in the parlance or the common expectations of the people that they had regarding the Messiah. Whenever Jesus and Peter and the other disciples were in the Garden of Gethsemane, and the mob came to arrest Jesus, Simon Peter pulled out his sword and cut off the high priest's servant's ear. I think the man's name was Malchus. And he cut his ear off. And Jesus said, "Peter, put your sword up. Those who take the sword will die by it." And then when he stood before Pontius Pilate, he said to Pilate, to more or less assuage any fears that Pilate had, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." Pilate said, "Are you then a king?" Jesus said, "I am." But he said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight so that I might not be delivered to the Jews. But," he says, "as it is, my kingdom is not from the world." So Jesus would not allow them to push him into any mold that they had preconceived or pre-molded for him before he came. Now, I want you to notice something. Here was this man who absolutely and resolutely refused to have anything to do with the politically motivated anticipations of the Jewish people regarding the Messiah. He was not going to be the head of some marauding band. He was not going to come in and be the kind of Messiah that they were looking for. He could care less about whether the Romans occupied Israel. And whenever they came and asked him questions about whether they should pay taxes or not, he said, "Certainly pay your taxes. Give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Give to God the things that are God's." And yet I want you to watch something. Here was a man who refused stoutly to be pushed into the messianic mold of the present mind of the Jewish people. And yet, all of the other 64 false Christs, and that may be 63 or plus or minus, but the 64 false Christs that I've read, I haven't read about them all, and I may be making an overstatement, but I think we're safe to say that all 64 of those false Christs who did come, they came in the common mold of the people of that day. They came expecting to be a liberator and a deliverer of the children of Israel in some militaristic manner. Now, that's true all the way back from Judas Maccabeus, the hammer, in 175 B.C., all the way through to Bar Kokhba, the revolutionary, in 72 A.D., when he and some, I forget now how many revolutionaries, holed up in the Masada down near the Dead Sea. That was in 72. And then later on, in 125 A.D., we have another rebellion that was staged in a little mountain stronghold overlooking the Galilee Sea. That stronghold is called Mount Arabel. I've been up in that one. And I know that, and there you could find their weapons room. You could find their dining room. You found where they shot the arrows at the Romans. These people were insurrectionists. All others of these 64 false Christs, and we know of some of them. We know the name of Bar Kokhba. We know the name of Judas Maccabeus. We know the name of Theudas and Judas. If you want to turn to an interesting passage, look at Acts, the 5th chapter. We have here a reference to two of these revolutionaries, Judas and Theudas. It was after the church was established and these disciples of Jesus were arrested by the Jewish authorities, and then a Pharisee named Gamaliel, who was the major professor of the Apostle Paul, he came in and said, "Now look, men, take care of what you're doing with these men," verse 36, "for before these days Theudas arose, giving himself out to be somebody, and a number of men, about 400, joined him. But he was slain, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After him, Judas the Galilean arose in the days of the census and drew away some of the people after him. He also perished, and all who followed him were scattered, That was in A.D. 6. Jesus was about 11 years old when that insurrection happened. So you see, from all, and I don't know how far back you would want to go to start getting these people who were false Christs, perhaps sincere people, but nevertheless, false Christs. I don't know how far back you want to go or how far down you want to come. But in and around those years of time of the Jewish people in which Jesus lived, there were some 64 false Christs, 64 people coming, claiming to be deliverers of Israel, and every last one of them fit the mold of a materialistic kind of deliverer, and every last one of them failed. Now, here was a man who stoutly refused to fit that mold, who said, I am not that kind of a Messiah, you can't make me that kind of a Messiah, and yet he's the one, and he's about the only one whose name you even know. And his influence is the strongest, it's the most widely spread, it is completely the most universal of any man's influence that's ever lived upon the face of the earth. I think that's meaningful. Jesus Christ was a man whose presence was contrary to local human expectations, and yet he succeeded in spite of that. He could have had a following at just the snap of his finger, but he says, I'm not going to go that direction. And his disciples loved him in spite of the fact that they misunderstood him. They loved him and committed themselves to him, and he just simply would not fit their preconceived notion of the Messiah. Something else. He didn't fit or accept the limitations that reason placed upon him that should have been part of a human being. For example, in Matthew, the 11th chapter, Jesus said, there, come to me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly in heart. Meek and lowly in heart. Listen, do you get the impression that he was meek and lowly? I do. Everything about him was meekness and lowliness. He condescended to associate with the lowliest of people. Blind people, beggars, people who had leprosy, tax collectors. It just didn't make any difference. Jesus was a man for men. He was a man of the people. He was meek. He was lowly. And yet, watch here. This meek and lowly man claimed that Moses wrote about him. Moses wrote about me, he said. Secondly, he said, Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. This man claimed to be greater than Solomon. That's right. A greater than Solomon is here. This man wept over the city of Jerusalem. And I want you to notice that in the light of the fact that he claimed that Moses wrote about him, that Abraham saw his day and was glad, and that he was greater than Solomon, and you could add other things in here that show what he thought or knew of himself, and yet he was a meek and lowly man, but then add to all of that, and in the light of all these things that he said about himself, I want you to examine something in Matthew, the 23rd chapter, where Jesus said, Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, stoning those that are sent unto thee and killing the prophets, how often would I have gathered thy children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. I want you to examine that in the light of these statements that he was before Abraham, that Moses wrote about him, that he's greater than Solomon. And I think you're going to be pushed to the conclusion that whenever Jesus said, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. Those times that Jesus was referring to as his being willing to gather those children of Israel under his wings, that didn't span just 3 years. I'm confident that what he's talking about here was the fact that over the entire history of the Jewish race, all of the years, the eons of Jerusalem's age, of her history, that he had come on many occasions and had asked them, please return to me. And they had killed the prophets. They had destroyed those that had been sent to him, to them. And Jesus stood there as the age of the ages. He stood there as the King of Kings. He stood there as the one who was before Abraham, as the one about whom Moses wrote. He was the one that stood there, greater than Solomon. And recalling all those times when he had come to them in the body and in the presence of the prophets and those sent to them to call them to repentance, and he refers to that and says, how many times I have tried to get you to return to me, but you wouldn't do it. That is astonishing to me, but that's the kind of man we're studying about tonight. And then you add to that all of the I ams of John's gospel. There are about 14 of them. You may want to just flip through here with me. Let's do it quickly. Look at John 4. He calls himself the Christ there. John, I'm going to give the verse and the chapter now, and let's hurry to go through it. John 4:26, I am the Christ. John 6:35, I am the bread of life. John 6:35. John 7:37, he essentially calls himself there the water of life. He says, if any man is athirst, let him come to me and drink. He's calling himself essentially the water of life. John 8:12, I am the light of the world. He that follows me shall not walk in darkness, but shall have the light of life. John 8:58 is that magnificent one which we'd have to call the peak of all these I am claims. He said, before Abraham was born, I am. Not I was, but he uses the same construction that God used to give his name in the Old Testament. I am because I am. Jesus said before Abraham was born, I am. And then again in John 9:37, he says, I am the Son of Man. That was a messianic designation, the Son of Man. He says, I am that Son of Man. In chapter 10:11, I am the Good Shepherd. That was a direct reference to Ezekiel 34:11-16, where Jehovah says, I myself will become their shepherd. And he sent away those false shepherds who feed themselves and who eat of the flock but don't feed the flock. He says, I'm going to become my shepherd, or the shepherd for my own sheep, says Jehovah. Then John 10:36, he says, I am the Son of God. We don't have a record where he said it definitely or directly. 10:36 simply says that he had said that. He said, he quotes a prophecy out of the Old Testament and says there, the word of God called, said, verse 34, Jesus answered them, is it not written in your law? I said, you are God. That's chapter 10, verse 34. Is it not written in your law? I said, you are gods. Now, he says, if he called them gods to whom the word of God came, and scripture can't be broken, he says, do you say of him whom the Father consecrated and sent into the world, you're blaspheming because I said I am the Son of God? So you see, they were pouncing upon him for claiming to be the Son of God. It's another one of the I ams of John's gospel. Chapter 11, verse 25, I am the resurrection and the life. Chapter 14:6, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Chapter 14:10, I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. Chapter 15:1, I am the true vine. My Father is the husbandman or the vine dresser. You see, the vine was the symbol and is still the national symbol of the Jewish race. The Jewish nation of Israel still is symbolized by two men carrying on their shoulders a huge stick. And in between those two men is this huge, beautiful cluster of grapes. Jesus said of himself, I am the true vine. So you have this man and you have him claiming such magnificent things. He claims to be the Christ, the bread of life, the water of life, the light of the world. He claims to have been before Abraham. He claims to be the Son of Man, the Good Shepherd, the Son of God, the resurrection and the life, the way, the truth, and the life. He is in the Father is in him, the true vine. Now, all of this man claims. He just simply was a man whose presence could not be contained within the normal concepts of that which normally describes a human being. He didn't fit the popular expectations of the Messiah, and he would not allow other people to confine him to what reason would demand that he be as a human being. He says, I'm meek and lowly in heart, and yet he claims all of these things about himself, and that's the man with whom we're confronted tonight. The Christ of the Gospels is truly universal. We've seen that he was historical, yes. He was born at a certain time. He was born into a historical, geographical situation. We know that. History bears record to him, not just his friends, but history itself, in the sense of secular history, bears witness to it. We've noticed that in the past. He was a man who was subject to the normal things of life, to the normal vicissitudes of fortune, you might say. We're truly aware of his Jewish ancestry. We know that he spoke the Aramaic language. We know his religious background. We know his customs. We know his dress. We knew what he normally did on the Saturday. He normally went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. We know so many of these things about him that lock him into a historical, geographical setting. And yet, he was universal if there ever was a man that was universal. And he was timeless if there ever was a man who was timeless. And to a degree to which no one else has ever achieved, this man steps out of the boundaries of history and time and becomes timeless and becomes universal. That man who said he had not a place to lay his head, That man who had no place to lay his head has left his footprints in the minds of countless millions of people all over the world. The great Gandhi of India, the father of modern-day India, was one of the men who so admired Jesus of Nazareth. He never became a Christian in the formal sense of the word, but he absolutely idolized the man. He idolized Jesus of Nazareth, and he thought that the Sermon on the Mount was the very epitome of all wisdom. Well, all of these things, his words, they are contained in a historic text. They're contained in an ancient text that to most of you looks like Greek. And that's where it is contained. It's contained in the Greek language. And to most of you, it looks like chicken scratching. But that's where all about him is contained. It's there in an historical record. And it seems like that though it rises out of an ancient text, it invades every century and every country from that time until the present. And it will be just like he says, my words will never pass away. Jesus, before he died, in Matthew the 24th chapter, says heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. I'm telling you what, if he was just a human being, that is the most bald-faced braggery I've ever heard of. But on the lips of Jesus, it fits just as nicely as if that's exactly where it should have been placed. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. It seems as though his teachings ought to be quaint. They ought to be parochial. They ought to be more or less out of touch with society of today, but they're not. They're as far in advance of today's society as they were in advance of that society that was 2,000 years ago. They should seem to be impractical, but they're not. They've passed the test of every society on earth. Wherever men have gone and have taken the teachings of Jesus Christ, these teachings have worked. You might as well admit it, the man was universal and timeless. His teachings should seem Jewish. They should seem alien. They should seem ancient, but they're not. I'll tell you one thing. Jesus of Nazareth stands head and shoulders above all people. He stands head and shoulders above all time. Jesus of Nazareth is universal and eternal. Both he and his teachings are universal. They're eternal. And he himself said that this would be the characteristic of them. When he told his disciples to go into all the world, he made known that my teachings are to be universal. He sent them out into the whole world, and that's where they've been for 2,000 years. And no one has ever judged them to be irrelevant or unimportant. They've always been revolutionary. They've always fit the human need. They've always challenged the human heart. They've always thrilled the human imagination. They've always inspired human hope. Jesus of Nazareth, a Jew, olive-colored in his skin, wearing a robe that is completely foreign to you and me, wearing sandals on his feet, walking dirt roads, living in a little town not any bigger than Kensett. And yet, who else do you know that has such a reputation as Jesus? Who else do you know that can produce such credentials as Jesus? Geographical, yes. Parochial, yes. And yet eternal and timeless and universal. That's Jesus. Now, in conclusion, this universality is profoundly significant for this reason. Because if Jesus were the creation of somebody's imagination, and you know that's what the other option is. Let me just say this very briefly. There are four options concerning Jesus of Nazareth, and you're going to have to reckon with him. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do in the next several weeks. I'm going to push you off of a limb. I'm going to push you out on it, and I'm going to saw it out from under you. And you're either going to sink or swim. You're either going to go away from here cursing him or worshiping him, but you're not going to ignore him. That's right. There are four options, and you have to choose one of these. He was either a liar, he was a lunatic, he was a legend, and that is somebody invented him, you know, out of their own imagination. They sat down and decided they were going to imagine him and invent him, you know, and add all these things to him and make him some kind of an imaginative character. That's one option. He was either a liar, doing it intentionally, or else he was a lunatic, thinking himself to be all these things, but wrong. Or else he was just simply the product of somebody's inventive imagination. He was a legend. Or else he could be very well what he claimed to be, and that's the fourth option. He could be Lord. But if he's a legend, I want to show you how the universality of Jesus debunks such a claim as that. Jesus of Nazareth could not possibly have been invented by people of his day for this simple reason. Had he been invented by the people of his day, had he been the victim or the creation of their imagination, he would bear the marks of his time and place. He would have smelled like a Jew. He would have been a Jew. he would have had everything about him as being Jewish, as being of that age 2,000 years ago. He would not have been able to stand up and be the representative of every man of every age and of every generation and country from that day to this. He wouldn't have been a universal figure like he is today had he been imagined by someone back there, because they would not have been able to ascribe and to ascend or to arise to the universality that characterizes Jesus. We've seen that he frustrated the popular messianic expectations of his own people, even his own disciples, and yet he won their undying devotion to where in the first century at least 1 million of the people who were followers of his went to the gallows or went to the crosses or went to death. And I think someone said it even approaches 2 million people in that first century who died because they believed Jesus of Nazareth was what he claimed to be. No Jew inventing a new Messiah would have dared created a person like Jesus. Wouldn't have done it. He couldn't have done it. No, Jesus of Nazareth is the man that just doesn't fit into that kind of a category. He's either a liar, he's a lunatic, he's a legend, or he's Lord. But listen to me. The only real, genuine, and sincere evaluation of this man is he must be what he claims to be. He must be Lord. And so this is the man. I present him to you tonight by way of preview. I present him exulting in his majesty. I present him with anticipation. I present him to you gladly and happily. This is the man that we're going to be studying about. This is my Lord. It's your Lord. Many of you who are here tonight. Some of you don't know him, but by the grace of God, you will know him in the process of your study over the years, you'll come to know him more and more. And so we extend to you the invitation tonight even. You may be here tonight and your faith is sufficient, and maybe something that's been said tonight has caused your faith to top out and to come to such a degree and to such a level that you say, well, now, wait a minute. I don't want to go any further in life until I become his disciple. If that be true, you're going to have to take him as Lord, as he claims, as the Son of God, as he claims, as the Christ. If you can swallow all of that, and I say it because it's a pretty big mouthful, because it demands that if he is these things, he's your God. And he has the right to claim everything about you, and he owns you. If you're willing to give him that kind of obedience and acknowledge him as that, then we extend to you the invitation to confess your faith in him and be baptized, to be immersed into him as an adult, willfully, knowledgeably, give yourself fully and freely to him. If you want to do that, this is your opportunity while we stand and sing.